Welcome to the live version of Truth Jihad Radio right here on Revolution Radio. On the web at freedomslips.com, I'm Kevin Barrett, your host, doing the live show every week. Revolution Radio is the leading listener-supported network out there. And it beats PBS, public radio, all those places that always ask you for money. So if you do want to ever give money to any kind of listener-supported radio, don't waste your money on the fascist nincompoops at National Public Radio or Wisconsin Public Radio, which is what afflicts my eardrums when I drive here in Wisconsin, or any of those other propaganda Big Brother networks. Instead, give it to Revolution Radio. And better yet, you could even go to truthjihad.com and sign up as a subscriber. Don't worry, the NSA will not immediately disappear you if you become a supporter of the Truth Jihad. It's the one kind of jihad that you can be proud to support and perhaps not even get shipped to Guantanamo for your trouble. Enough messages from our sponsors. Let's move on to tonight's broadcast. Well, let's see. What are we up to tonight? We've got a couple of excellent guests, as pretty much always here on Truth Jihad Radio. We broke the story of whistleblower Rahul Manchanda here on Truth Jihad Radio a couple of days ago. Well, Henry McCoe, I guess, broke it the day before we did, but we broke the story live talking to him, listening to this incredible tale of how a guy who was groomed to be a professional propagandist on CNN and Fox News and was taken in by the Freemasons and by the CIA and sent to propagandize for the invasion of Iraq, and then was sent to Iran on a fact-finding mission. The purpose, of course, was not to find facts, but to drum up war propaganda against Iran. And when he came back, he couldn't do that because he'd seen what was really going on in Iran. He saw Iran was no threat whatsoever. And when he refused to write that warmongering report that they demanded of him, suddenly his life turned into a living hell, and he's been a persecuted whistleblower ever since. Well, let's see if we can get Rahul on the line here. I'm going to see if I can bring him up. And meanwhile, as we bring him up, I'll mention that the second hour guest, David Allen Glynn, has written what may be the best 9/11 truth-themed thriller yet. I've read a whole bunch of them. Steve Alton made a big splash a while back. This new book, Vigilant Guardians by David Allen Glynn, kicks Steve Alton's butt all the way back to wherever Steve is, Ohio or wherever he's from. This is a really good book. It's right up there with Thomas Pynchon's 9/11 book, Dark, whatever that was. Anyway, it's incredibly good stuff. So we'll talk with David about it in the second hour. Let's see if we got Rahul on the line here. We're trying to get through to Rahul. And we're having a little slow connection here, so we're hoping it's going to work. Otherwise, I'm going to have to go to a replacement guest or start welcoming call-ins early. If you do want to call in to Truth Jihad Radio's live show, there's only one way to do it, and that is to send a Skype request to me, Dr. Kevin Barrett. That's D-R-K-E-V-I-N. B-A-R-R-E-T-T. That's D-R-K-E-V-I-N-B-A-R-R-E-T-T. And if you send that Skype request, then I'll be able to bring you on as a caller. So this is a Skype-only call-in show. And it pretty much works that way. Now, don't try to call me. Just put in that request. And then I will bring you up here at Revolution Radio when it's time to bring you on the air. So be patient, just kind of hang out, and then I'll try to bring you up. That's how we're going to take calls here. All right. Well, we've got this funny thing happening. As I try to bring up Rahul, it looks like it's just not happening. So let's see if I can try that one again. I did interview Rahul earlier this week, and it worked that time. But man, he's had... Are we here? Okay, sorry about that technical problem, folks. We're still trying to find a way to bring up Rahul. I think we're going to get him here. Let's try one more time. There we go. Let's see here. I think we got him. Rahul, are you there?
I'm here. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can. It's funny. I've got this little clock that's going off ticking. And oh, yeah, there you are. Now, you don't have to have your camera on because nobody can see you except me. So save your bandwidth and turn off that camera, even though you're actually, okay, you know, good enough looking to be a television commentator, which is why they had you on Fox and CNN and all those places doing propaganda. I'm really pretty much fit only for radio, so that's why I don't do the visuals. But man, hey, it's good to have you back. I appreciate whistleblowers. Go ahead. You were going to talk about the courts.
I'm sorry. I'm still trying to figure out.
Okay, yeah, the way you turn your camera off is you just move your cursor around under the picture, and you'll see a little camera icon, and you just click on that camera icon, and that'll turn off your camera, and that'll save your bandwidth for audio. So that's what we do here on the radio show. You don't have – there you go. You got it.
Got you. Can you hear me?
Yeah, now
you can hear me okay? Because you're going in and out. The volume is going in and out. Your voice is going in and out, so.
Yeah, yours was. It sounds a little better, though, since you turned off the picture.
Okay.
Yeah, you're coming through okay.
Okay.
So, yeah, I just introduced you, mentioned how you were groomed to be a mainstream propagandist. You know, you're a first-rate lawyer, a good talker. You have a good face for TV. They put you on Fox and CNN to sell the Iraq War. They sent you to Iran to try to get some propaganda against Iran, and you refused. And since then, you've been having all kinds of problems. And you wanted to talk tonight a little bit about the way that our courts and police are controlled by the deep state.
Well, yeah, you know, I was actually put on CNN Fox to analyze the Iraq War, not to sell it per se, but that's sort of the propaganda mechanism. I'm an Indian American brown guy. It looks kind of it's fit for popular consumption. But the bottom line is that's how they suck you in. You know, the first they give you a couple shows like, you know, the Natalie Holloway case or something like that, or something innocuous like the Michael Jackson thing. And then they start asking you deeper questions about the Middle East. You know, and then all of a sudden you find yourself, you know, justifying or arguing for the, you know, where you send on the Palestinian-Israeli conflict and things like that. So they suck you in that way. And, I really drew the line when it stopped becoming analysis and started becoming propaganda, and especially with regards to the Iranian situation. I mean, I was over there in the country and I wrote a report. And I felt that, you know, that it would be best to, you know, go for peace with the Iranians in terms of, you know, a dialogue instead of a carpet bombing war, which is what these neocons want, these Nazis that have infected the U.S. foreign policy. Are you there?
Yeah. Well, I couldn't have said that better myself, but they wouldn't let me on CNN or Fox to say that. They had me on Fox a couple of times, but I haven't been invited back since 2006.
Well, you know, it's people don't know that, you know, and I've only learned this recently, that we really didn't defeat the Nazis. We defeated the Germans, you know, and the reality is that the Nazis are still alive and well. They came here in Operation Paperclip. They're here. They've infected our foreign policy. They've infiltrated the Freemasons. They've infiltrated, you know, all these organizations. And this neocon militant adventurism policy of constant warfare, attacking every single country that, you know, doesn't want to have a international banking system, doesn't want to be interlinked with that, is up for grabs. And it's all about bullying, and I don't agree with it. And I was over there in Iran. I met people. I talked to hundreds of people there. And my feeling of the country was that it was incredibly gracious people. The economy was destitute because of these sanctions. They were very pro-American, the people in the streets. They were very pro-American, pro-West. You know, and they just really wanted to live their life and just live in peace and not be bulldozed and carpet bombed to the Stone Age. So I didn't get that sensation that the Western propaganda was feeding me before I left on that trip.
Yeah, you know, my impressions of Iran are fairly close to yours, although I probably was dealing with different folks over there in different contexts. Although the economy didn't look that bad to me. I've been to Morocco, where half the population is illiterate and living in very serious poverty. Half the population can basically afford to live on sugar in their mint tea and really cheap white bread, and that's about all they could afford to eat. And as I say, half the population's illiterate. So, you know, Morocco economically is really a basket case in a lot of ways. And I've been to Turkey. When I was in Turkey a few years ago, Turkey had just been doing practically double-digit economic growth for many, many years. It was growing faster than China. And Iran looked to me like it was booming just about as much as Turkey was. There was all kinds of construction going on. You know, this is just over the last couple of years. They manufacture more cars than any other Middle Eastern country. They manufacture all of their own stuff. And then they have a very capable scientific and technological sector that's put satellites into space, their own satellites, even though they're completely boycotted by the world, ostensibly anyway, they're able to put satellites in space. So to me, it didn't look like they were doing all that badly. And frankly, I'm a little concerned that if these sanctions end, the powers that be are going to try to drag them into the international banking system. And they're going to have to work hard to maintain their integrity and independence and so on.
No, exactly right. And, you know, the thing is, I think that the Iranian economy was on life support when I was there. I mean, they were basically supported by the Russians and the Germans, and I think the Chinese, to some extent, the Indians. Obviously, there was no Western or American trade, or very little. So whatever you saw there, whatever you saw there in terms of prosperity was probably through the BRICS nations: Brazil, Russia, India, China, South Africa. Well, actually, at the time, it wasn't South Africa, but you know. And you're right about that. I mean, this is a currency war, in my opinion. This is about the international bankers, and you know, this is all about join us or die. And the enforcement arm is, I think, NATO. You know, that's the military arm of the international banking system, and all these intelligence agencies are on the same team. You know, the British, American, Israeli, Indian, I think to some extent raw, but not necessarily so the latter. But they're all, you know, it's a free Masonic situation that's going on right now.
Let's talk a little bit about the Freemasons, because that's a topic that isn't really widely known, except maybe to readers of Henry McCoe and other specialists. But it's pretty obvious that 9/11 was a coup d'etat within Freemasonry. After all, the biggest symbols in Freemasonry are the twin towers of the you know, the original Freemason. You know, what is it? Hiram the Builder, Joachim and Boaz, and then the pentagram. So what got hit on 9/11? The twin towers and the Pentagon. And this is obviously a message to Freemasonry by the people that pulled this off, that, hey, we're in charge now.
Yeah, and I think they're just client states and agents of Freemasonry. I think the State of Israel is essentially a client state of Freemasonry. It is an experiment. You know, the Jewish people are and Israeli people are very good people. It's just their leadership has hijacked it. Their leadership are predominantly Freemasons or high-level Masons that are carrying out the will of Masonry. I think some of the Saudis may be agents of them. Feminazi group, feminist groups, for example, are agents of Freemasonry. They're all there to divide and conquer. And this is all about ushering the Third World War. And, you know, this is what Albert Pike and Giuseppe Mazzini used to talk about, back in the day, late 1800s, early 1900s, about ushering the Third World War. There's going to be three world wars, and I think this is the final one. And they're just on a collision course for warfare right now. And these overtures of peace are not really boding well with the Masons. They don't want peace. They don't want a two-state solution in Israel. They don't want the Palestinians to have any rights, and they don't want peace with Iran. They want a war with Zionism versus Islam, and I think it's an absolutely insane, crazy road that they're on. But it's hell or high water for them, one way or another.
Well, you know, I would have thought that there would be some differences of opinion in Freemasonry, just like in so many other places. I know that with the CIA, for example, Robert David Steele, a CIA whistleblower who's become the world's leading advocate of open source intelligence, was on this show a few days ago, saying that there are seven different CIAs. And personally, I don't know the CIA that well to be able to distinguish all seven, but I can tell that there's a neocon wing, which seems to be dominant. And then there's a sort of a liberal CIA wing that has worked with some of the Rockefellers and people like that, and is a little more peacenik. There are these veterans, defectors from CIA, who kind of have their own team or work together sometimes. There's a whole lot of groups. And likewise in Freemasonry, I would think the reason that they did 9/11 as this huge message to Freemasonry by blowing up they're hitting the three main symbols of Freemasonry would be precisely because there is this neocon group within Freemasonry is saying, okay, we're in charge now. We're going to go on this, all out. demonization of Islam and you know, get the Christians fighting the Muslims, and that's what we're going to be doing, and you guys better all fall into line. But I would think, just like at CFR, Council on Foreign Relations, there are some good people, or, you know, some idealistic people. They're not all neocons. They're not all Satanists. Richard Falk is on CFR, and he's a very good, honest man. I've had him on the show many times. He's recommended the new book, We Are Not Charlie Hebdo, bless his heart. And so CFR is a debating society set up by the folks that really run things, and they allow a certain spectrum of divergent opinion to come in there and debate, including some real idealists like Richard Falk. Likewise, I would think Freemasonry has everything from, you know, the guy at the local temple or whatever they call their coven or, you know, the lodge, who's just kind of, you know, flipping hamburgers for them and, you know, putting on the beanie or whatever they wear to go on their 4th of July parade. All the way up to, you know, closer to the top, you would find people of different shades of opinion. So I don't think it could be all that monolithic, but I mean, maybe I'm wrong. You think that the whole world of Masonry is ultimately pretty monolithic?
Well, I don't think so. I think that, like we talked about earlier, I think that whenever you have, you know, the lower level or the beat cops or the agents, you know, and the lower level Masons, I don't think they have any clue. You know, there's a saying, there's more light in Masonry as you go higher and higher in the degrees. And what does more light in Masonry mean? You know, the word Lucifer is derived from the word light. And basically, Luciferianism just talks about how, you know, they essentially believe that, you know, with more light, you become more godlike. And the higher you go, essentially, you become a god man, if you will. I don't really subscribe to that. I think that sounds Luciferian to me. Deus meum quae jus, according, God according to my right, order ab caio, order out of chaos. These are the higher tenets of Masonry. You know, Aleister Huck, Crowley talked about do what thou wilt. You know, this is Satanism to me. I think that man should always be fearful of God or of a God-like figure and always be humble in front of that whenever they make decisions. But if you have the power of life and death because you're blessed with so much capital, hundreds of billions of dollars of capital, and you're blessed with all this power over mankind, you know, look at the world right now. Do you think it's in a good place right now? I don't think it's in a very good place. People are dying everywhere. There's wars everywhere. You know, so clearly, you know, they're not doing a very good job if they have all this power. So, you know, my feeling is that the lower level people, you know, they'll allow a little dissent, you know, a little controlled resistance or controlled opposition. But I think at the top levels, you know, the writing's on the wall and they want to go there. So they hide behind the shadows. They're not going to come out and show who they are.
And we may have some listeners who haven't delved into this topic and would think that we're a little goofy to think that Freemasons are so powerful. But, you know, just for a sort of an introduction to a vision of the world or a description of the world which acknowledges the power of these Masonic secret societies, I would recommend that people read The Lost Symbol by Dan Brown, which is a wonderful sort of architectural tour of Washington, D.C., pointing out that D.C. is just one big Freemasonic symbol, architecturally speaking, in terms of its street layout and so on, the grid. And it's totally run by Freemasons behind the scenes. And it's very well described in that novel. And frankly, I think that when Dan Brown is describing that when there, you know, there's some kind of problem going on, the guy in the Secret Service picks up the phone and talks to a Freemason in the White House with, you know, using the Freemasonic secret telephone handshake or whatever, and they go and call the Freemason in the CIA, and they call the Freemason in the federal courts, and they all kind of work together to solve the problem. That's how he describes basically how everything gets done in D.C.
Well, I think
it probably does.
I think that Masonry, like any other institution, has been infiltrated by very, very aggressive individuals and entities. I think Masonry stands for brotherhood, love, loyalty, doing good, and that's sort of how they, you know, bring you into it, and they tell you all about that in the first couple of degrees. But, you know, I think it's been hijacked, if you will, by, you know, foreign policy hawks. You know, people who have global visions of the way the world should be. I mean, we've all heard about the Illuminati and Adam Weishaupt, those organizations. But I think that, like any other organization, you know, even say a private corporation, a private law firm, you know, there's a senior partner out there who wants you to win a case, and he doesn't matter how you do it, just do it. You know, and that's the bottom line. They don't care how you get it done, just get it done. And they may have a vision for what they want the world to be like, but they have all these agents and entities that work for them. So, you know, I think that, you know, divide and conquer is the name of the game, and they have a vision for the world and how they want it to be. And I think some of their methods might be construed to be a little bit too aggressive.
Well, you know, according to, I think it was Treasury Secretary O'Neill, when Bush hit the White House in January of 2001, the first thing they all did was sit down and everybody said, okay, what we're going to do is we're going to invade Iraq, and here's how we're going to divide up the oil fields, you know, yada, yada. And Bush finished the meeting by saying, show me a way to get it done. And I guess they did show him, didn't they, by blowing up the World Trade Center and you know, hitting the Pentagon with a bomb or a cruise missile or whatever it was.
Well, they were talking about how Dick Cheney wanted to politicize the intelligence for Iraq. I guess he was getting feedback from the intelligence operatives on the ground who were not giving him the answers he wanted. And I think there was a story about how he said that, go back to the drawing room and find me the information I needed. I think I read something along those lines. But the bottom line is that just like any other company, they don't care how you get it done; just get it done.
Right.
And unfortunately, you know, in this situation, hundreds of millions of lives can be lost in that kind of a bargaining. I think intelligence should be about reporting what you see, and obviously the analysis, you know, is made. But at the same time, to lie or to politicize it is incredibly unethical and wrong, and it results in death and destruction.
And the people who don't believe what we're saying would say, like, well, how could these people cover up these misdeeds? You know, somebody would certainly have an attack of conscience and tell the truth. I think those people who say that don't understand how the game is played at these levels. You know, Henry Kissinger famously said, he said the illegal we can do right away, the unconstitutional takes a little longer. And Daniel Ellsberg said that when he was working with top-level people at RAND Corporation and connections to National Security Council and the highest levels of government, he said that the questions that you should never ask, or you will be kicked out and never invited back again, your career will be ruined and you'll be kicked out of town, are, is this legal and is this ethical? You're just, you know, saying anything like that and you're out. So that's the world that these people inhabit. And so the whole notion that, oh yeah, well, they could never do any of these big crimes because somebody would blow the whistle is just laughable.
No, and they openly, like, look at Ray McGovern, the quote-unquote intelligence activist, or Michael Schur. These people are never invited to the parties, and they're kicked out when they get there. I think Ray McGovern was dragged out kicking and screaming. I think they broke his arm or something like that. You know, he's an intelligence operative for 35, 40 years, and he's treated like persona non grata simply because he disagrees with, you know, the outcomes or, you know, the results. I think that, you know, there is no room for disagreement there. And they weed you out just like they do with the Masons. So they allow for controlled dissent, but I think that you're not going to be invited back, is what I'm saying.
Yeah, and Ray McGovern used to be the president's daily briefer for the CIA. He was the guy who would go to the president and tell him what was going on in the world. That's a pretty important position. It's pretty close to chief of staff, which is considered the second most powerful position in the world by some people. You've been photographed with President Bush as well, although I imagine you weren't giving him direct CIA briefings every day or anything like that. But you were on the inside.
I'm not saying at all that I was in the CIA.
No.
I interviewed with them, and let's make that very clear. I'm not saying that at all.
Right. But of course, we all know that the CIA assets and people kind of connected with it are all over the place. I mean, Operation Mockingbird, the CIA media control operation, planted thousands of people in the media. They basically owned most of the most important media owners. They had huge numbers of major mainstream people on their payroll, and I don't think that ever ended.
Well, I mean, propaganda is in full force and effect, and I think that they were talking about an experimental propaganda news wing during when Secretary Rumsfeld was Secretary of Defense. They were talking about that. I mean, they certainly needed help. Like I said earlier, I mean, the Nazi sort of ideology was transplanted to the United States in the 40s. The Nazi ideology of full propaganda was in full effect back then. Why should we be surprised if Wernher von Braun can come here and, establish NASA and transform, the OSS and the CIA? Why couldn't they have transformed the media into a completely state-controlled mechanism where all the major studio heads are part and parcel of the operation against the American people to brainwash them into certain policies that they may not necessarily agree with. So it's not too far-fetched to think that might occur.
Webster Tarpley has talked about this. He thinks that Roosevelt really was a very strong anti-fascist but that he was assassinated, and that these sort of pro-Nazi forces, the same people who had tried to overthrow Roosevelt in that Smedley-Butler coup attempt, in which the DuPonts and other among the wealthiest families had recruited Smedley-Butler to be the American Hitler. And rather than, you know, he pretended to go along with it for a while, and then he went to Congress and blew the whistle. It's all in the congressional record, but none of those people ever got prosecuted for trying to overthrow the government of the United States and install a Nazi dictatorship. So Webster thinks that those kind of people, the sort of, you know, Nazi financier elite, killed Roosevelt and kind of installed a lot of these Nazi methods into the national security state after World War II. And frankly, I think he's not completely wrong.
I wouldn't, you know, there's a lot that we don't know about. There's a lot in the shadows. I mean, obviously, you know, with more light, you know, more light is revealed. You know, it certainly seems that way. I mean, you know, you can call it a neoconservative, you can call it a Nazi, you can call it whatever you want. But the bottom line is they're not Ron Paul, you know, and they're definitely out there, you know, killing and murdering, you know, hundreds of thousands of people in the name of whatever. And it doesn't make any sense. It's vile. And it's sick. It's a sick philosophy. It's a sick policy, and it needs to be looked at.
Indeed. Well, let's talk a little bit about Freemasonry in the courts. This seems to be better known in the UK. You know, many of my sophisticated UK guests and people I know from there just take it for granted that the Freemasons dominate the courts. And here in the US, it seems like that's not so well known. But your experience has been that it seems that our courts are partly controlled by these Freemasonic networks.
Well, I think in the UK there was I think Henry Straw, who I think it was one of the top guys in the Home Secretary's office, stated that any judges and police officers had to disclose their membership in Freemasonry. This is, I think, about 10 years ago, because it was getting so out of control. And you look at, you know, the whole pedophile scandal with the MPs in London, that just was covered up and swept under the rug. Nobody was prosecuted. I think they just threw their hands up and said, we'll just fine people £500 or something ridiculous like that for these horrific crimes against children that went on for decades and was covered up. I mean, the question you have to ask yourself is, who covered that up and how could they cover something like that up? Something so egregious and grotesque. And I think that the U.S. is moving in that direction. I think we, you know, we talked about that in a different program that, you know, like I said, different agencies and entities and NGOs are founded to carry out the will of these Masons. You know, you've got feminist organizations, certain, you know, civil rights organizations that can do no wrong and intimidate the judges. You know, and like we talked about earlier, some of these federal judges are picked right out of large law firms, big cushy big law firms, where their clients are banks and corporations. They never suffered a day in their life. They played tennis. You know, they went to prep school, you know, all the way up there, and they never, you know, worked, you know. They don't even know what a civil right is. They've never suffered a civil right violation, yet they're presiding over civil rights cases. So, you know, the courts are supposed to be the last refuge of justice. I mean, just today, Chief Justice Roberts in the Supreme Court stated in an opinion, which is a landmark opinion, that judges, as opposed to legislative and executive branches, are absolutely now forbidden to take money or take donations, campaign donations, or any kind of special interest lobbying donations in their election campaigns. This is just today, by the way. You know, you've got to understand that for a long time, the legislative and executive would routinely take money, right? Goldman Sachs, that whole thing, corporations. But apparently Justice Roberts today announced that there has to be a bright line with the judiciary in the courts, because maybe somebody's listening to our radio broadcasts, but I was actually shocked by this opinion today, and this is Supreme Court law of the land.
Interesting, because they've been basically taking off all of the restrictions on money in politics, but here it looks like they're putting one back on.
Well, you know, for the judges, that is, the courts, you know, I don't know about the legislative and executive, but certainly for the courts, I mean, the opinion was very clear. What he said was that the states are now free to regulate and free to prohibit judges from accepting, you know, campaign finances and monies from a different source, you know, from special interest groups. But it doesn't mean that the states will take advantage of that, but it just says that the states are now free to do that. Before, you know, it was a freedom of speech thing, a First Amendment thing, just like the legislators and the executives would say. But there is definitely a hidden hand in the courts. You know, I've seen it in 15 years of my law practice, both as a lawyer and as a litigant. I've seen things that just don't make any sense. And I think, you know, the nature of the common law system and you know, is that nothing's black and white. The common law is based on judicial interpretation of the statutes. And if they want to nail you, they'll nail you. If they want to get you, they'll get you. Even if you're innocent, even if you're right, it doesn't make a difference. And it's a very, very scary process to be either a litigant or a lawyer with an unfavorable judge who abuses their power. And the judicial abuse is at an all-time high. People can't get any justice. They file a lawsuit in federal state court and they get dismissed out of hand because, you know, the judge doesn't want to hear it or doesn't think it has merit. The judges are acting like kings in this country. And I think there's a problem with that. I think if we don't have the, you know, the courts as a remedy, where the hell are we going to go? You know, before, so the courts are really our last remedy, to sort of rectify things that happen. And when you've got a control or hidden hand or hidden power with these senior judges or these federal judges or people that are handpicked in these very, very, you know, very shady and shadowy ways, and they have all these links to these moneyed organizations, you know, there is no justice.
Well, I've spoken with William Pepper a number of times about the possibility of trying to bring the people in the Bush-Cheney administration, for example, to justice for perpetrating 9/11, the worst crime ever committed on American soil. And he believes that it's not worth the effort unless you're able to find the right litigant in the right court and you're going to get the right judge. And it's very, very hard because most of them are, as you're suggesting, pretty much on the take or you know, made men and women. They're pretty much just never going to give you a fair hearing on that kind of a case. So the key thing in going into federal court, according to Bill Pepper, is shopping very carefully for the venue and then making sure you have the right case in the right venue. He was never able to find one that was going to work for 9/11. And he was successful with Martin Luther King. He won that case for the King family, proving that the CIA, FBI, and U.S. Army murdered Dr. King. And the King family's been screaming from the rooftops about it ever since. And he's now working on the Sirhan Sirhan case, Sirhan being the mind-controlled patsy who was set up to take the blame for the CIA killing of Bobby Kennedy in 1968 in the Ambassador Hotel. So that was his take. And you know, I think that you've been in law for some time. Do you also agree that being very, very careful about what kind of court you're going into and who the judge is going to be is key?
Well, see, that's part of the problem. You know, it's actually you cannot forum shop, you cannot venue shop. That's actually prohibited now. Courts throw cases out more than ever based on the wrong forum, and you can't pick a judge. Certainly, you can't pick a judge. Even if the judge is abusive and egregious to you, even if you file a complaint, they don't get dismissed from the case. They actually retaliate against you. All the commissions, for judicial conduct, those oversight bodies are actually, in my opinion, in bed with the judges. So if you file a complaint, not only does it get dismissed, but you get treated even worse. So, the other thing you're talking about venue shopping. Sometimes you remember the Jim Garrison case, the DA in Louisiana who brought that case on the Kennedy assassination and how much trouble he got. He wasn't able to be victorious, but, he still tried. So, the key is to keep trying. If you've got a legitimate beef, you got to keep coming back and make as much noise as possible. And, the courts are a public record and hopefully you get somewhere and you just keep appealing until you get to the very top. Don't be daunted by the denials of some of these handpicked judges who literally, are working for the enemy.
But of course, we've seen lawyers sanctioned and fined heavily for impugning the integrity of federal judges, both in the April Gallup case, in which Bill Veal, her attorney, was sanctioned for impugning the integrity of Judge John Walker, who is a cousin of George W. Bush, the president that April Gallup was accusing of carrying out the 9/11 attacks. And so simply by asking Bush's cousin to recuse himself from that case, he got himself sanctioned and fined. And likewise, the lawyer for Ellen Mariani in New York also had exactly the same situation where Judge, I believe it was Judge Hellerstein, angrily fined him and sanctioned him for impugning the integrity of Hellerstein for a guy with massive conflicts of interest. Half his family's over in Israel. He's from an old Zionist family. And Mariani was, of course, going after the security companies, the Israeli security companies that controlled airports, and then there was, of course, the Trade Center security under Larry Silverstein, and so on and so forth. So, you know, these people ended up being fined. I think I forget what the amounts were, but they were something, you know, $20,000, $40,000, a lot of money, and having this put on their records. So it's been really ugly so far in efforts to get any 9/11 justice in the federal courts.
Oh, it's very scary, and it's very daunting. But, you know, the appeal process is there. You know, you just got to keep going higher and higher. You got to file complaints and keep going. You know, don't accept, you know, the sanctions. You just got to keep moving. File a complaint against the judge who issued that. You know, you can go to the Second Circuit. You can go to the circuit courts, which are above the district courts. You can file a complaint there. You can take an appeal to the circuit courts. Go all the way you can. Talk to the media. That's what you have to do. When you find that you're being stonewalled by this hidden power, this shadowy power that sits around and just decides to be king, you know, this is the United States of America. You've got to fight. You know, I think, you know, Thomas Jefferson said that those who expect to reap the benefits of freedom must endure the labor and toil of supporting it. You know, and in the absence of law, there's tyranny. You know, so the bottom line is, you know, like a Davy and Goliath situation, you've just got to keep going, and keep filing appeals and keep doing it and talk to the media while you're doing it. And that's the best that you can do, unfortunately.
The real problem is the media doesn't report this stuff. You know, here we had Bush's cousin, you know, sanctioning a lawyer in this high-profile 9/11 case. You'd think it would be high-profile. And it was completely hushed up by the mainstream media. They also totally covered up the New York case with Ellen Mariani in Judge Hellerstein's court, and they covered up all of the litigation actually relating to 9/11 and the Susan Lindauer case, where she was locked up in on an Air Force base under the Patriot Act because she was blowing the whistle on 9/11 and the war in Iraq. So there's been this long, you know, history that suggests that post 9/11, some of these national security issues, such as 9/11 truth, have been flagged, and the mainstream media won't cover it. So you can, you know, you can be, you know, dealt as big an injustice as they want, and the New York Times is never even going to mention you. Or if they do, as they did with Susan Lindauer, they're going to grossly misreport the story.
Well, that's why alternative media like yours is absolutely essential. You are a hero. You are one of the most important people out there because you're actually giving people a forum. You know, that's why, you know, you can never give up. And other alternative media sources, it's absolutely essential because you do have a following, and it's important that you don't give up and give people the voice. That's exactly why you're doing what you're doing, and it's a very courageous thing and very heroic what you're doing.
Well, I appreciate that. Yeah, well, if the media is not doing their job, somebody's got to do it. It's a dirty job, but somebody's got to do it. Yeah. So did you want to talk about your case at all, or maybe, and I'm sure that not all the details are things that you can talk about on the air, but you know, you've been put through the ringer.
Well, yeah, I've seen it firsthand myself. I mean, there's my story's out there. The bottom line is, I'm experiencing that as well. I mean, there are certain agents and elements that are very, in my opinion, very linked to corrupt NGOs and organizations that are heavily on the take financially, and they, you know, they intimidate. And they have a very cozy relationship with the people involved. And I think it's a politically motivated issue. You know, it's very political. There's retaliation elements about some of my political views. And I believe strongly that, you know, especially as an attorney and as a litigant, I've seen how badly I've been screwed. Every single motion that I would file would be denied even before they were read. Evidence would be thrown out or misplaced. You know, the opposition would be given legal advice in the middle of the courts while I was ridiculed openly. You know, it's a very frustrating thing. And when you complain, it falls on deaf ears. You know, these supervising agencies are, like I said, part and parcel of the problem. So, you know, I've gone through it myself, and I'm going through it. And, you know, it's very clearly retaliation for expressing, my feelings, you know, especially about the Iran war. I mean, potentially going to Iran. I wasn't for it. I thought that, you know, we should, you know, achieve peace through peaceful mechanisms and not through outright war. And when I wrote that report in 2007, my whole world collapsed. You know, I started getting audited by the government, Department of Labor audits, tax audits, disciplinary audits, defamed character assassinations on the internet hitherto unknown. It was unbelievable. The blitzkrieg within a few months. Women's rights groups were seeking out my ex-wife and trying to convince her to divorce me. They were representing her for free. I mean, I was literally attacked, and I can't even describe the levels. And they're still trying. They're still trying to destroy me for my report to not go to war. I just don't. Sometimes I don't even know what country I'm in. I can't believe it that this is happening.
And based on the story that Henry McCoe reported, my interpretation of it is that you very likely were the target of some undercover operations designed to mess with your personal life in order to slander you.
Yeah, I mean, you know, obviously, that definitely occurred. You know, it's very hard to make a declaration like that. But at the same time, the patterns were there. I spent 7 or 8 years looking at the situation, asking myself why this was occurring. And it just makes sense that where it was coming from. And I've done my own research just to find out where it was coming from. And there's definitely a very heavy neoconservative, super Zionist Nazi agenda in this country. And if you go against the grain, if they put you in a position and if you go against the grain politically, there's hell to pay. And that's it. And, you know, this is the way to get you back. And we all know it, you know. Unfortunately for me, you know, like you said earlier, nobody wants to hear my story. Nobody wants to listen. It's an incredibly painful process.
I think the Iran issue is very important. You know, that's the one that's really in play in the sense that there's, you know, a real fight within the powers that be about whether we're going to go on to have this war with Iran or not. And of course, that was on the drawing board. They were planning to go there. You know, 9/11 was designed to take out 7 countries in 5 years. The biggest and most important one would come at the end, and that would be Iran. Well, they got a little behind schedule. They had to use other means like the Arab Spring and coup d'etat and things like that. And they've destabilized a lot of the Middle East. Israel is much safer now because there are not stable, prosperous governments, or at least not as many. The region's in chaos. But they still haven't taken out Iran. And so that's what's in play. The realists are pushing back, saying, no, we're not going to fight Iran. That's strategically stupid. And the neoconservatives are saying, but we must fight Iran. And so that's the big political fight. You got kind of caught in the middle of that. And today there's the Jade Helm issue that's been blown up in the alternative media. And there are really two interpretations of this. One interpretation is that Jade Helm is a plan for martial law, and they're going to basically round us all up this summer. Dissidents will be extracted and will be sent to Walmart or wherever, the concentration camps. And so that's the kind of stuff we're hearing from Alex Jones and a lot of other people. And then we're hearing from the other side, the management over at Veterans Today, led by Gordon Duff, saying that, no, what's actually going on here is that the neocons who want this war with Iran are whipping up Jade Helm hysteria precisely in order to destabilize the Obama administration, and that the fear propaganda is really about empowering neocons and ultimately getting that war with Iran, so we shouldn't fall for it. So that's been the debate, and I'm listening to both sides, and frankly, I kind of lean a little bit to Duff's side. It looks to me like there's a kind of a psyop aspect to the Jade Helm hysteria, that, you know, it's not exactly what it seems. I'm also very suspicious whenever I see fear-mongering and I see people reacting fearfully rather than thinking calmly. What's your take on that?
I think they're both partially correct. I think that, you know, what comes to my mind immediately is that why did the DHS buy up all the bullets for the last 5 or 10 years? Why are they buying up all the, you know, the ammunition? Why are they building FEMA camps? Why are they, you know, buying, you know, tens of millions of coffins and putting them all over the fields? You know, I think they're gearing up for civil war. I think that they're thinking that there's going to be a revolution or something, and I think that they're afraid of that. I think that they're, you know, I have a few friends that are in the Marine Corps that tell me about how at the upper echelons of the military power, they were terminating those high level military officers who would not turn on their own people at the behest of, you know, the executive branch. So, I think that if you're a patriot, I think you're being driven out. I think that the test of whether or not you rise, just like in anything that we've talked about, is whether or not you toe the line and play the game. And if you're an honest person, if you're a patriotic American, and you know what the Constitution's all about, you're a persona non grata. You're an enemy, potential enemy. So I really feel that this is an internal exercise geared towards the American people. I don't think it has anything to do with Iran. I think it has to do with the fact that they're expecting, you know, and as the economy worsens, people are getting more and more desperate. We see this in Baltimore playing out. You know, Ron Paul just went on the record today about how he feels that the riots are really about the socioeconomic destruction that these inner cities are facing right now with this economy. And the chasm between the haves and the have-nots is so ridiculous at this point that it almost begs for socialism. A guy like Bernie Sanders, for the first time in history, a socialist, an open socialist like Bernie Sanders, has tens of millions of followers because people want wealth redistribution. They don't understand why these hedge fund guys can make $1 million a day, and they won't even get a wage increase from $7.50 an hour to $10 an hour. They don't understand that, and for good reason. So the information is out there. I think that, you know, we're heading towards a plutocracy, and that the Republicans have also they're trying to outlaw the death tax or the estate tax. So these young trust fund billionaire cokeheads, some of these guys are getting richer and richer, and they're just laughing at the poor. They're living in a different world. It's a tale of two cities. It's never been clearer than now. And the people are aware of that. They see the Facebook pages. They see the social media. They see how people's lives are different than theirs. And they're angry about it. They're incredibly angry about it. And they're looking to blame somebody. And I think the government is very, very, very attuned to this. They're very aware of this. And they're very worried about it. And so they I think they're preparing for some type of revolution. The feds just raided, I think it was the secessionist movement in Texas. A bunch of guys, people getting together, talking about seceding Texas from the Union, right? So this raiding just happened 2 weeks ago. So I think that the plutocracy and the oligarchy, the ruling class, with their serving government, are getting very nervous, and they're preparing for a populist revolt. That's my opinion.
It looks like it, you know, whether these are all contingency plans or whether they might actually set it all off somehow, who knows? You know, traditional way of basically confusing issues and diverting domestic unrest against somebody other than the people that they should really be mad at is by starting a war, going after some foreign external enemy. But they're not having that much luck right now. Nobody really wants to attack Iran. Nobody really wants to go all out in Syria. And certainly nobody wants an all-out shooting war with Russia. Putin today probably is more popular than any American politician, even here in America. They haven't succeeded in demonizing him. So trying to demonize an external enemy at this point might not work. It doesn't seem like there's any easy way for them to do it.
The only solution right now that I can see is the middle class has to come back. There has to be some sort of wealth redistribution. I hate to say that. It doesn't sound very American. It
doesn't sound like Ron Paul either.
Yeah, I mean, well, you know, Ron Paul is all about ending the Fed. You know, he thinks that, you know, ending the Fed and then, you know, an audit in the Fed and ending it, he thinks that will return the economy back to, I guess, Keynesian economics, you know, in terms of, you know, that kind of thing, putting a gold standard or an oil standard up there. You know, that's very sound, but that will take a long time, maybe a generation, to whip the country back in shape. We need some sort of desperate measure in terms of wealth redistribution. I used to be a conservative myself. And I can't believe I'm talking like this, but there has to be some sort of, I mean, the amount of money that is in the hands of so few is so obscene at this point. And they're not sharing it. The banks aren't lending money anymore. You know, it's very hard to get a loan. The poor are getting even poorer, and it's getting more and more desperate. So there has to be some sort of wealth, some sort of socialist wealth redistribution, maybe an FDR, maybe a New Deal situation, you know, where they're, you know, maybe, but it's so un-American to talk like that. You know, that, you know, it's almost like Che Guevara-esque.
Yeah, well, I actually always kind of admire Che Guevara. I mean, I have a libertarian side, too. But yeah, today I think that obviously we do need something that will quickly get the country back to work and get some money in the pockets of the bottom 50% and even the bottom 99%. And it seems that that 1% tax on Wall Street transactions that's been proposed by Danielle Wallace and the Tax Wall Street Party, who was on my show a while back, makes a lot of sense to me. You know, so many of these transactions on Wall Street are just speculative casino gambling, and they're really not bringing any social benefit. And just a 1% tax on them might very well bring in practically enough money to run the government just with that. I mean, to me, that's a no-brainer that you put a sales tax on Wall Street just like you have a sales tax down at the hardware store. What are your thoughts?
Well, you know, I mean, we talked last time about the Glass-Steagall Act and how that was, that's something we need. Again, that line, that division between, you know, the people's savings and checking accounts and these banks that are investing their money and losing their money and loaning it out on these risky loans, they're just basically playing poker with mom and pop savings and houses and mortgages. You know, the Glass-Steagall has to be put back into place, and we need some sort of wealth redistribution. I mean, on one hand, I applaud the Obama administration with Holder that they were going after the banks. They didn't put anybody in jail for the financial crisis, but they certainly went after the banks and sanctioned some of them. I think Bank of America, $18 billion penalty. But that's not enough. That's a drop in the bucket. You know, that's one quarter. But there has to be some sort of wealth redistribution. And how we do that in an American way is something not for me to decide. That's for the economists to think about. But there has to be something like that. Otherwise, we are definitely heading towards, I think, possibly genocide, you know, civil war. And unfortunately, I hate to say that. I think we're going to be plunged into a third world war. I think it's going to be a big conflict. And I think the people are thinking about it. People are worried.
So you think the Freemasons in charge, or the neocon Freemasons, actually might be planning to start a world war and reduce the population?
Well, like I said, I think the Freemasons have been infiltrated. I think that if you have an opinion that doesn't mesh with theirs, they push you out. But I think that the neocons, the Nazi philosophy of militant adventurism, the joiners are get out of the way, banking cartels, you know, how dare you have your own internal banking system in a country, say, you know, I mean, this is what it's all about. It's not about terrorism, that's for sure. That kind of attitude is driving us towards a new world order, which is, you know, and the Patriot Act, for example, it has just completely eviscerated our civil rights. I mean, our First Amendment, Second, Third, Fourth, Fifth, Sixth Amendments are being vitiated. These judges that are being plucked from these big law firms are further eroding our civil rights. The marriage between corporations, banks, and the government is further eroding that. So I think it's definitely falling within the lines of, you know, people like George Soros, who want a new world order. They want a streamlined new world order. They want one global governance, one banking system. Even the carbon tax, for example, that was kicked around about 5 years ago. That was proposed to sort of help the environment, right? This is what they always do. They always pass these draconian, horrible laws, these federal laws, under the guise of trying to protect something. So the VAWA law was passed to protect women and girls, but that killed the First, Second, Third, Fourth, Fifth, Sixth Amendment. Same with the child support laws, which incarcerate you if you miss a child support payment. That killed the 13th Amendment, prohibition against slavery. NAFTA completely wrecked the economy. I think that even now the TTIP, I think it is, right?
Trans-Pacific Partnership is coming in. It's like NAFTA on steroids.
The carbon tax was kicked around for a while by these green globalists who said that we want to save the world, and they were going to tax the countries that produced more carbon emissions, and therefore you had to pay more money. And it was really a nice idea in spirit, but remember, the power to tax is the power to destroy. And so if you have the power to tax on a global scale, you have the power to destroy the globe.
Right. Well, according to David Griffin, I'll just give you the devil's advocate response to that. David Griffin's new book, Unprecedented, makes an argument that the global warming problem is all too real and will thoroughly trash civilization by the end of this century if we don't get super active in cutting back carbon. Now, I know most of my listeners are going to be unsure or skeptical about that view, but if that's true, and of course it's a scientific question, then what Griffin argues is that a carbon tax, obviously not administered by an international body so much as by sovereign nation states by international agreement. And of course, if there was a nation that was cheating or didn't want to tax their carbon, then of course there could be the penalties on trade with that nation, etc. But you know he makes the case that such a tax wouldn't be such a bad thing at all, that it could be set up in such a way as to make sure that the poorer people didn't get screwed over by it, and that it would make as much sense to tax by way of taxing carbon as to tax all these other things that we tax now, like income, property, sales, and so on.
Yeah, nobody would agree with that. I mean, you know, saving the environment is absolutely, it's paramount. But the problem is the implementation of the law, if and when it's drafted, who's going to draft it? What is it going to say? You know, like a thief in the night, these laws come like a thief in the night. The enactment of the Federal Reserve in 1913, you know, there was nobody voting on it. Christmas Eve, 1913, the Federal Reserve Act came into play, you know. So, you know,
it's yeah, that was a coup d'etat. Definitely.
Yeah, the Patriot Act was written before September 11th, ready to go. So, you know, these things are always passed under severe emotionalism. And when, you know, and unfortunately, when we get what we get, when we get it, it's never, it never helps what the underlying problem was. And it's just used to socially control the people. And that's really what this is all about. It's about social control, getting rid of our civil liberties, getting rid of our civil rights, eradicating our freedoms, and making global governance of the masses a lot easier by the banks and the corporations. That's what this is all about. And if the carbon tax, no one's going to disagree that it's a good thing, that in terms of helping the environment. But if it's going to be used for a global governance sort of structure, then you know this is TTIP on steroids. This is the euro on steroids. This is all they need. This is the common denominator. Everybody breathes and everybody produces carbon dioxide.
And of course, that was my response to David, was if we move towards global cooperation to save the world from the carbon problem, aren't we just empowering those same abusive institutions and individuals that we're responsible for, let's say, 9/11?
Yep. Global cooperation very quickly becomes global tyranny. Very quickly.
Right. Well, we're certainly we're facing some serious problems in the world, and we're not going to solve them unless we get some transparency and some honesty. And all of the secrecy and the lying that's going on today is just making it impossible for any kind of coherent strategy to address the problems. So I would say start with that issue. Start with the transparency and the honesty. Let's get some accurate information, and then we can make decisions about these other issues.
Like I said, I'm a big proponent of filing federal lawsuits left and right. Just file lawsuits. Whenever you're, if you're in middle America, if you're aggrieved about something, file a lawsuit. You know, because it's open, it's transparent. Face those people in the eye, and look at them. I mean, you know, this is you know, the courts are supposed to be the last vestige of civilized dispute resolution, right? The problem, however, as we talked about earlier, is that the courts are now being subverted and subjugated, and they're being diminished as we speak. And these special interest groups, whatever they are, agents of the powers that be, are being mobilized against the people. And today's, you know, opinion by Justice Roberts was a very good thing. You know, he was very clear about saying that the states can now regulate whether or not judges are allowed to have this appearance of impropriety hanging around with all these moneyed special interests and lobbying groups. But there's a long way to go. And we've definitely got to fight for the courts. We've already lost our legislative. We've already lost the executive to the corporations and the bankers. We've lost them. They work for Goldman Sachs, you know, and certain special lobbies and interests. But if we lose our judges, we're screwed as a nation.
I think we've already lost a lot of them. The federal courts are not in good shape. I've been told that some of the state courts are actually a lot better. But the federal courts, I think, have been the object of a concerted takeover.
Yeah, there's no question about that. I mean, it is pretty bad out there, but you know, like I said, information is power. You know, if people know about it and they talk about it, then maybe there'll be some meaningful change.
Well, that's what we do here on Truth Jihad Radio. Is we talk about these issues, and especially the most important ones that are being covered up, or misreported, or not reported, and you know, somebody's got to do it. They weren't letting you say these things on Fox and CNN, were they?
Well, Kevin, I'd like to think you're the fourth you're the fourth branch of the government.
The fourth estate, Truth Jihad Radio. That's a concept. You know, we were supposed to have a break here, but for some reason the music didn't come on and the messages didn't come on, and that's okay. That means so much more actual Truth Jihad Radio for you, the listener. And I was going to, during the break, I was going to dig out my other guest, David Allen Glynn, who's got this great new 9/11 truth novel. Well, it's not quite new, but, you know, it's pretty recent. Vigilant Guardians, which is aptly named, of course. That was one of the, 46 drills of 9/11. Vigilant Guardian. raising the specter of the platonic guardians, the self-appointed class of national security experts who think that they're above the law, so they can do whatever it takes to protect the polity and, of course, protect and enrich themselves. And as Plato said, who will guard the guardians? Well, these days, we sure could use some guardians because our guardians are completely out of control. And I think that this novel, Vigilant Guardians, paints a more accurate picture of the kind of guardians we have in our society today than what you would get from the mainstream portrayal in the textbooks, in the universities, and in the media. So we're gonna pull him up, but it's going to take a second here because I thought I was going to be able to do this during the break, and we didn't have a break. So I don't know whether Revolution Radio's switchboard fell asleep or something or what, but here, let me see if I can figure out how to get a hold of David Allen Glynn. There we go. Okay, so we're gonna bring him into the conversation. And Rahul, did you want to stick around and talk a little bit with David?
Oh, whatever you prefer. I mean, I'm easy. Yeah.
Okay. Well, let's try and bring David into the conversation. We're gonna, through the magic of Skype, we're gonna pull David up all the way from Australia. Now, I've had different levels of quality with my connections to Australia in the past. So we'll see how this works, but it sure is amazing that we can even do this. Hello, David. Are you there?
I think I'm here, Kevin.
You are. Hey, and I'm here too. And so
it's a miracle.
So is Rahul Manchanda, my first hour guest, who's hanging out. But let's talk a little bit about your novel, Vigilant Guardians. This is a great book, David. I'm so impressed. This is a really, really good thriller.
Well, I'm glad to hear that, Kevin. I have to say, thank you.
Yes, you know, just as what was Pynchon's 9/11 novel called? Dark, whatever it was. It's going dark in my brain right now. It really amazed people that Pynchon was able to really get the late 1990s New York culture down so perfectly.
Yeah.
And likewise in Vigilant Guardians, you know, you're Aussie, but you've got American culture down perfectly. Are you like spying on us over here or something?
Well, first thing to say is I'm not actually from Australia. I'm a New Zealander by birth. And secondly, not really spying, but just doing the research and hopefully doing it well enough to convince people.
Right. I mean, I think that anybody reading this book would assume it was written by a U.S. American.
Right.
And it's also really well constructed. This is your first novel. You've written some nonfiction, but it's uncommonly well done. You know, not to put down some of my previous 9/11 truth novelist guests, Rebecca Roth, whose book is a bestseller these days. Mm. And that's a great book as far as, you know, pinning down some aspects of 9/11. And it's certainly readable. But in terms of, shall we say, you know, quality of writing as a thriller, you know, you're really head and shoulders above all of the competition except Pynchon. So, hey, congratulations on that one.
Well, that's high praise indeed, Kevin. Thank you very much.
Yeah, well, thank you. I'm halfway through the book, and you know, probably I'll stay up all night finishing it after the show.
Yeah.
And so, how long have you known about 9/11, and how did you get interested?
I think I first got interested, I lived in London and I was there in 2007. And when the putative terrorist attacks occurred on the underground there, we lived not far away from one of the stations. And after that, I heard a man talking on the radio about how they'd been conducting exercises that were, spookily enough, exactly the same as the events that were transpiring or had transpired on that day. Mm-hmm. And that was really, more than anything, the thing that caught my attention. And I thought, hang on, that sounds kind of familiar and also very weird. So that's where I really started investigating. So that was my in, as it were. And after that, I kind of got obsessed, as people do. And I spent at least 4 or 5 years just delving into every aspect of 9/11 itself that I could find and trying to solve it. That was really the thing for me. I thought, well, here's the thing that they're telling us happened in this particular manner, but patently it didn't, observably so. So what really did happen? What actually transpired before and on that day? And that was where I was coming from, trying to work it out for myself.
And that's how your book, Vigilant Guardians, kind of frames itself as a writer tries to recreate 9/11 in fictional form, because the official story, as outrageously improbable or nay impossible as it is still a very compelling story. The 9/11 Commission Report is a very compelling thriller novel, even though it has very little to do with reality. And if you follow the footnotes, you know, all you get is, oh, well, this all came from this guy, you know, being tortured. not directly. This is what we heard from the torturers that he might have said while he was being tortured. That's pretty much where the footnotes lead you. So it's really that's just a novel. But you point out in your book that the official story, despite its ludicrous improbability, makes such a good story that people just buy it. And how do we respond when we're trying to explain that, no, that wasn't the truth? If all we say is, well, the official story doesn't make any sense, then they'll say, well, then what happened? And generally, what can you come up with that they're going to accept as being equally or more probable? And so that's kind of the problem that your book starts out with. And it does a really interesting job at sort of giving us a little meta-fictional perspective on this.
Yeah. Well, I've been kind of thinking of an analogy or a metaphor, as it were, for the problem that we face, I think. And I likened it to a jigsaw puzzle. Say you're presented with a 1,000-piece jigsaw puzzle. You open the box, but what you find is half of the original puzzle pieces are in there, but there's also 250 pieces from a completely different puzzle, and 250 pieces are missing entirely. And from that, you have to try and finish the puzzle, or finish it, you know, well enough that you can get the idea of what the entire picture may or may not look like. And it's actually technically impossible, given the information that we have and the information that we don't have and the misinformation in between. You can't do it, but you can only do the best that you can. And I tried to come up with a scenario that made sense, given, based on all of the fundamental aspects that cannot be denied. That was my goal, as it were.
And interestingly, you and Rebecca Roth used kind of the same insight to construct your alternative versions, which would be that these alleged cell phone calls that we were told that were supposedly made from 30,000 feet on hijacked planes couldn't possibly have been made from those planes. They probably wouldn't even been made from the planes on the ground because of their Faraday cages. And you know, these calls went on for a long time. And they were reported to be cell phone calls, and it was only years later at the Massawi trial that the FBI completely changed the story and tried to insist that most of them were actually air phone calls. So both you and Rebecca Roth have said, okay, like if there were these actual cell phone calls, which there appear to have been, they had to have been made from the ground. And this is a key insight in figuring out what happened.
Yeah, no, that was fundamental to my process. Because, again, you have to discount all of the things that are impossible. And it seemed to me, categorically, cell phone calls from the air were impossible. So they had to have been made, if they were indeed made. Which isn't to say I don't think all of them were in any way. But the evidence that we have is that so much of the reported phone calls are taken as second or third hand sources of their veracity anyway. But the ones that we're absolutely sure of, because they are recorded, particularly Betty Ong's call, it simply couldn't have been made from the air, so it had to come from the ground. And so you work within the constraints of the story, and, well, how could that happen within the ongoing unfolding events? So, yeah, we were coming from the same direction there, definitely.
And I think Rebecca Roth and you would agree that there were some issues with Betty Ong's call, for example, For instance, Rebecca pointed out that had this actually been made from the plane, as we were told, that, you know, her way of describing, like, oh, where are we? I see tall buildings. Yeah. I see skyscrapers. Oh, my God, it's the Twin Towers. You know, it was like it sounded really scripted.
Yes. Well, that's the whole point to me. It seemed it had to have been at least scripted to some degree, and it was just by reading the transcript. Patently not a genuine article. And that's, I think, what any thinking person has to do, is look at what's being presented as a fact or a piece of information and say, well, does that conform with reality as I understand it? And if it doesn't, you have to, you know, try and work out why it exists and what purpose it's trying to achieve.
Another interesting aspect of your book is the notion that if you start to figure out what really happened on 9/11, they'll come after you. And in terms of reality, you know, Wayne Madsen has said that there are 1,000 full-time employees at NSA whose job has been to keep a lid on 9/11. And you imagine this in a kind of a sinister vein, although, you know, people like me have been beating the 9/11 truth drums for more than a decade, and we're still here.
No, I fully understand that, and that's one of the things that it kind of vaguely troubled me, because I know that's true. There are so many diligent and dedicated 9/11 researchers who, you know, haven't been actually murdered. But in the constructs of a, you know, what's supposed to be a commercial thriller, you have to have that kind of jeopardy involved for the reader, because that's, you know, the danger of death is, you know, it's the most thrilling aspect of or possibility. So I felt I had to do it that way. And the simple fact is that though there are many people who survive and carry on doing their work, there are those such as, you know, Philip Marshall, for example, who we could quite safely say probably was murdered by the powers that be, I believe, for his activities, or at least that's the way that it seems. So it does happen. I think there's a long list of, well, a list of 9/11 witnesses or researchers or whatever who have reached that ultimate end, I believe.
Yes, that's a good point. And then also, you know, even setting aside the question of how dangerous it is to investigate 9/11 and figure it out correctly, we all, in our imaginations, we all imagine that it must be, you know, even, you know, David Ray Griffin, I recall at one point said in his interviews that, well, you know, if they decide to kill me, then my book will just sell more copies. And so they'll have to stop and think about it. You know? And so we all sort of think about this. And if you talk to people on the street that are totally unhip to 9/11, they might say things like, well, if this were true, you know, you couldn't possibly be saying what you're saying to me because they would come and kill you. And so everybody's imagination immediately grips onto this. And just like the official story of 9/11 is such a good story because we've all flown in airplanes and we can just imagine, you know, we all get paranoid when we're in airplanes and we could imagine what it'd be like to have terrorists fly us into a building or something, you know, how horrible that would be. And we all get all excited imagining this and horrified. And likewise, once we figured out 9/11 truth, we all have this little sort of paranoid side inside our minds that's saying, oh, my God, are they going to come and take me away?
Yeah, no, it's absolutely true. And the whole point, one of the things I point out earlier is that in the novel is that there are so many, certainly Americans, who have died in unexplained or inexplicable airline crashes or airplane crashes. Mm-hmm. Paul Wellstone, I think, is the prime example, but there are literally dozens of people, not 9/11 researchers necessarily, but individuals who themselves have proven some kind of threat to the powers that be, whose plane has just mysteriously fallen out of the sky. It's kind of frightening.
It happens all the time. And I think John Perkins has explained why that is, because John Perkins, in his Confessions of an Economic Hitman, talked about how he was employed by the world's biggest bankers to go and pressure heads of state in third world countries try and convince them to take a whole pile of unrepayable loans that would accrue exponential interest so that the banksters could then move in and grab the country's resources as collateral for the unpayable debt. So his job was to convince the heads of state to go along with the program. He would say, I have a fistful of $100 bills in this hand, and I have a fistful of bullets in this hand. Which one do you want? And if the head of state said, get out of here, then he would go home and they would send in the asteroids, the world's leading, you know, high-paid assassins who are experts in, guess what, plane crashes is their favorite method. And they apparently like to cause cancers, too, as Hugo Chavez discovered to his chagrin. And Perkins knows that he knows these guys. You know, he's not just making this up.
Yeah, well, that's the thing. The notion that, you know, people have that such a world doesn't exist. It's just so patently errant and false. Yet at the same time, it's a very comforting notion, or rather, ignorance is bliss. And that's one of the very interesting things I've found about 9/11, is that why is it so difficult to convince the larger mass of people of even the possibility that, you know, it didn't happen the way that the official narrative tells us, because it is. It's inordinately difficult to, you know, if someone's mind is set, and so many, many people's are, you literally cannot demonstrate to them in any way, no matter how convincing you think your argument is, that, you know, that could possibly be a more valid explanation. And I find that, and that's one of the reasons why I wrote the book, just to see how far I could go in doing that.
I think this would be a good book to give to somebody who likes to read thrillers but hasn't figured out 9/11 yet. I wonder, you know, apparently some of the reviews on Amazon are by people who were like that and who came around to becoming truthers thanks to your book.
It's true, but there's also a couple of reviewers who have said also quite the opposite. You know, it's a really good thriller, and it's really engaging and well written, but it comes from a premise which is just untenable to my mind, as it were, and I'm not going to accept that because I know it not to be true. And so I've always thought that there's only one way any person really comes to any kind of change of mind, and that is through asking questions in and of themselves. I know that's what happened to me. I think you look at something and you go, well, that doesn't seem right to me. And that's the basis on which you start investigating, and you start accruing a different kind of set of information. And gradually over time, you can change your mind, but you can only do it if that germ or that seed of doubt is there. If someone's just going to hit you over the head with a 9/11 novel, you know, it's really still not going to happen that way.
Right, right. Well, you said that you first awakened to this sort of thing when you heard about Peter Power, who is the terror consultant over Advisor Consultants, who went on television right after the 7/7 London bombings in July 2005 and said, this is amazing. It's an astounding coincidence. These bombs went off at exactly the times and places that we had envisioned bombs going off in a drill that we were running at the same time.
Mm-hmm. You know, that's exactly it.
Yeah.
And you know,
can't make this stuff up.
No, you get a piece of information that like that presented to you and go, well, and I almost use profanity in that phrase. You know, what the hell? That it's just untenable, this notion that such a coincidence could exist. And so the parallels then with the Vigilant Guardians war games became, once I started investigating that, it became, again, immediately apparent that if you have a set of exercises which are basically doing a whole set of things, and then that is mirrored automatically in reality, the connection is too close to be coincidental in any real terms. But the thing for me that I really do want to mention is that all of this, in my mind, could easily be discounted if it weren't for what I consider the obvious, purely physical evidence that the 9/11 official narrative is incorrect. If it weren't for that, and I have to give credit in my case to David Chandler for his work on this subject, if it weren't for me, and I'm a science illiterate to all intents and purposes, but if it weren't for those or his illustrations of how physically the collapses of those buildings could not have happened in the way that NIST explains them to have, I still probably wouldn't be wholly convinced, really, not deep down, because the alternative that we outline is still, it does still beg a belief that, you know, the powers that be did what they did in that way. It's still hard to comprehend, for me at least.
Yeah, so I've come around to, it's less hard to comprehend now than it used to be, but even though I figured out the JFK assassination in high school back in the 1970s, it still took me 2 years to get my mind wrapped around 9/11 in terms of just how audacious and outrageous it was. But the issue of the war games and terror exercises. Well, actually, before we move on to that, just let me say, you know, with David Chandler's work, he showed that there was absolute free fall for the first couple of seconds of Building 7's so-called collapse, meaning that all vertical support had been completely removed. And the rest of the collapse is very close to free fall, too. And then he also did North Tower exploding, showing these blatant, you know, explosive demolition charges going off in the North Tower. So, yeah, he's done some very good work. Are those the two things that you noticed of his work?
And the third thing was his calculation of the downward force of the top portion of the North Tower, which was, according to the NIST explanation, supposed to have acted as a pile driver in crushing the larger undamaged section, which was 90 floors below it. And his calculation that because it was falling verifiably through video analysis at 66% of the speed or the acceleration due to gravity through the path of least resistance, and that therefore the lower portion was only providing a 36% of its resistance to that falling block, and physically it could not have achieved the destruction that NIST claims that it did. That was the third thing for me, which kind of cemented it, as it were.
Right. And it's so obvious, though, even to just the naked eye, when you look at these so-called collapses, I think especially with the South Tower, you know, that what they're telling us, which is, as you say, that this top block of these towers sort of came down like a pile driver and just, you know, crushed everything below it and turned it to talcum powder at close to freefall acceleration. This is not what you're seeing when you look
this is something that I actually put in the appendix of Vigilant Guardians. You see what you see, which is a building not collapsing, but you see a building exploding. I mean, if you take the collapse time as being somewhere between 13 and 15 seconds to occur, pretty much so that there's really nothing left after a maximum of 15 seconds, what you find is that for every second of that process, a seven-story section of the Twin Tower buildings disappeared into a giant expulsion of material, both solid chunks of steel girder and concrete, as you say, turned into talcum powder. And there's only one word for that in the English language. It's an explosion. It's nothing other than that, as far as I can see.
Right. And with the South Tower, that so-called pile driver, the top portion of the tower above the plane impact zone that they say was a pile driver that came down through the rest of it at free fall acceleration nearly, that so-called pile driver, what you see with the South Tower is it tips over, like close to 20 degrees. And if it hadn't been blown to bits, it would have continued to tip for, just very simple physics. An object in motion tends to remain in motion. So it should have just tipped over and fallen to the side as one piece. But instead, you can very clearly just see it being blasted into bits. And that's what arrests its motion, because it's no longer a solid piece anymore. It's been blasted to powder. And so there's no pile driver. They're just a bunch of powder.
Exactly. And as I say, this is what really astonishes me still, if I think about it, is that this is an observable event that any one of us can access virtually instantaneously. And it's so simple. Excuse me.
Yeah, well, neither of us are scientific geniuses.
No.
I mean, we don't have to be.
No, but you can imagine it in a, you know, if you've got a block standing on a few other blocks and you push it with your finger and it starts falling to the side, it's going to keep falling to the side. You know, it really is as simple as that. And people, I don't know, it really does still.
Yeah, and so somebody as smart as Noam Chomsky says, yeah. Well, I'm not a scientist, so I don't know what happened.
Yeah. Really?
What do you make of Chomsky?
I don't know. I mean, I just think my understanding, and as you know, I'm not an American and I'm not in any position of authority, but I think, like so many other people, you can't get into 9/11 truth in any way, shape, or form if you want to retain any kind of position within the complex, as it were. And I think that's where Chomsky's at with that. As are so many other people. You just become beyond the pale in so many ways, and it's not worth the effort. You know, that would be my feeling. For so many people, even if they see what might we consider to be reality or the truth, it's not worth it for them to pursue it. That would be my assumption.
Right. Well, I can sort of see that with people like John Nichols, who even as we speak has been doing an event just a few miles away from where I'm living. He's in Spring Green, Wisconsin right now at the bookstore and doing a Nation magazine event. They're celebrating a birthday of the Nation magazine. And you know, John Nichols has never gone there with 9/11, although I spoke to him privately once, and he let me know that he read Gore Vidal's piece Goat Song, which led him to Nafis Ahmed's work back just a year after 9/11. So he actually figured out 9/11 before I did.
Yeah.
And then he went on to say that, well, you can't really talk about this in polite company. You know, people might open up if you get a few drinks into them, but you just can't talk about it by daylight and be in a state of sobriety. He's basically says, you know, he gets it, but he's certainly not going to talk about it in public. And I can see that. I mean, he's, you know, he couldn't do his job if he did. But Chomsky doesn't just kind of nod and wink and say, well, yeah, but I just can't talk about that like Nichols and so many other people do. Chomsky adamantly bashes 9/11 truthers in the most deplorably, you know, pig-headed and illogical way. It's maddening. Talking to Chomsky about 9/11 is, it's not like talking to a brick wall. It's worse. It's like, you know, talking to a brick wall that's turning, you know, it's becoming a hallucination and melting and, you know, turning into a kaleidoscopic, you know, bad trip nightmare. I mean, this guy, I don't know what the heck is wrong with him. Some kind of psychological complex, maybe. I don't know.
Yeah, well, I think all I can say from my experience is that one of the reasons I've found that people don't want to embrace it, and my sister, for example, is a very good example of this, and her word is engage. She doesn't want to engage with it because it then opens up a world which is so utterly different to the one you think you inhabit and is so uncomfortable for people to contemplate inhabiting that the cognitive dissonance, as it were, is easier to live with than facing what becomes the true reality of things. So I kind of think that that is a way that many, many people contend with the notion, if they think about it at all.
Isn't it funny, though, that that's sort of the mirror image of what the conventional wisdom claims, you know, conspiracy theorists do. I mean, there's one line of so-called conventional wisdom on this that's still promulgated to a certain extent by the people in the academy that purport to be experts on so-called conspiracy theories and basically try to explain them away psychologically. And I've actually heard these people say that it's more comforting psychologically to imagine that your own government has, let's say, killed the president, Kennedy, and his brother, blown up the Twin Towers, murdered thousands of your countrymen. This is comforting psychologically, because if you didn't have this belief, you would imagine that the world is random and chaotic.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well,
I mean, these are professional psychologists who say this sometimes. It's mind-boggling.
It is. And it's an area that I try not to delve into so much these days because it becomes infuriating to me. The explanations of why, as you just put, people seek to believe in conspiracies or the conspiracy theory of history because it's a more comforting, it's a completely inane and utterly ridiculous concept. It's Orwellian when you get right down to it. But we live in Orwell's world now. That's the other thing that astonishes me, how prescient the great man was, because we do literally live in 1984. It's as simple as that.
And he's an icon, though, even in the mainstream. You know, the BBC, of course, lionizes Orwell at the same time that they cover up 9/11. And, you know, they cover up the fact that they reported Building 7 coming down 20 minutes before it did. You know, so, it's kind of Orwellian in the sense that they're lionizing Orwell while acting like Big Brother.
Yeah, no, it's categorically true. I mean, and Christopher Hitchens, God bless him, was the greatest example of that, you know. But again, it's doublethink in the sense that we are kind of obliged, if we want to get along, to hold oftentimes two diametrically opposed views at the same time and to accept that they both might be true. But now we're getting into areas of philosophy which I'm certainly not qualified to.
That's important. Famous American philosopher Ralph Waldo Emerson famously said that a foolish consistency is the hobgoblin of little minds.
Indeed, it's a classic quote. I do like that.
Right, and I think it's good to be able to entertain multiple perspectives and not collapse into certainty too quickly. And I've had arguments with my co-host Jim Fetzer, who works with me over at False Flag Weekly News, because I think he sometimes collapses into certainty too quickly. And sometimes he sort of just grabs the most paranoid interpretation and then becomes completely certain. And then we see confirmation bias. You know, I thought that was going on to a certain extent in his rabid insistence that Paul McCartney died in 1966 and was replaced by an imposter. I'm not saying that's definitively untrue, but I'm just saying that it seems that that kind of line of thought may have, but the trouble is these days grabbing the most paranoid alternative is often the best strategy. I mean, it's a good, it's general.
No, it's a good plan. I do agree. But I think the other thing, which is, on that topic, I think people probably need to remember that all knowledge is provisional. We have this idea that, suddenly we see the truth, as it were, or we understand something. And we may do so, but that is provisional only on the fact that it isn't going to be or hasn't been subsequently proved to be not necessarily the case. Because, throughout human history, the whole course of the progress of science has been in overturning what was assumed to be solid empirical fact. And proving that it was not necessarily the case, but then those proofs are also subject to change at any time. And that's, for myself, been one of the benchmarks of the process, is always assume that at some point you could easily have what you thought to be, the most solid and unequivocal fact or piece of information turn out to be wrong or incorrect.
Well, that's right. And I think as we try to figure out what's going on, and your book does get into that larger issue of all of the various kinds of questions related to 9/11 and how this all fits together to make sense of the world. And as we do that, when we look and we gaze fixedly at a particular event like 9/11 or a particular aspect of 9/11 or the JFK assassination, some of these other events, that event itself might become clear and sort of swim into focus for us if we study it closely enough, and we can become pretty certain about at least the broad outlines of what happened in these cases. Nobody has enough time. A lot of these other things floating around in kind of nebulous focus, where when we construct our worldview, some of it's going to be constructed on pretty accurate understandings of certain issues, but I don't think anybody is going to be really understanding all of these particular cases with any certainty.
No, not at all. You just simply can't. It's too complex. Your access to all of the facts is by definition profoundly limited. And so you just have to do, I think, the best job that you can as an individual, and approach it with a degree of logic and say to yourself, does this make sense to me? And I certainly found for the 9/11 question specifically, you know, I just went through everything that I could find and say, well, does that make sense in an isolated way? And then if that, then that, does that subsequent event make sense subsequently or consequently? And one of the most important things for me, one of the most interesting things, is I think people don't realize it or don't think about the fact that 9/11, the plan itself, didn't go according to plan, you know. And I think that's just such a profoundly important element in trying to work out what the actual plan or the actual sequence of events was supposed to be. I don't think in any way, shape or form the plan was for Building 7 to be brought down at 5:20 that afternoon. And I certainly don't think the plan was in any way for Flight 93 to have ended up wherever it may have ended up, in a strip mine in Pennsylvania or, you know, further down a few miles, collapsing or, you know, breaking up in pieces into a lake. That wasn't the plan to me.
So 93 was going to hit Building 7?
Well, that's what I've always, well, not always, but past a certain point, that's my assumption, because it makes the most logical sense. You've got a hijacked plane that doesn't reach whatever its putative destination is, and you've got a building that just miraculously falls down. So this notion that they are separate and distinct doesn't make, or didn't make any sense to me in real terms. So that's the assumption that I make.
I think that's a reasonable assumption, although my only caveat would be that the scripted revolt of the passengers, the heroic passengers revolting on Flight 93, is clearly scripted, and it's such a classic element of the story, such a gripping and necessary element of the overall story, the let's roll aspect, that one wonders whether that wasn't originally scripted. You know, what you're suggesting is that would have had to have been a contingency plan that got brought out due to perhaps Flight 93 leaving late and it couldn't be, you know, guided towards Building 7 or what have you. But that's such an important part of the narrative. I mean, that was a heck of an improvisation if it was an improv.
Well, it was, but I think we find that, you know, the fundamental part of that narrative, which is Todd Beamer's contribution, that story, from my understanding, didn't actually reach the world until at least 2 days after the fact. So on the one hand, you could say that it was necessary, and it was necessary to come up with it, you know, on the fly, as it were, if that was the case. But on the other hand, the world didn't hear of that for at least 48 hours, and which is quite a lot of time to then, you know, to start generating. And, you know, there's no recording of Todd Beamer's phone call, for example. We have no physical empirical evidence of any of that. We have a secondhand report from a, you know, a minor player in the narrative. So though it seems wholly authoritative to us now after the fact, you can also see how it was or could have been extemporized, you know, in a desperate attempt to, you know, to get things to look a certain way, would be my only.
Well, the Beamer phone call is a very strange aspect of the 9/11 story. Supposedly he was on the phone with the operator for more than 10 minutes as this, you know, hijacked plane was heading for its doom. And he expressed no interest in talking to his family. Instead, he ranted about religion to an unknown telephone operator for 10 minutes.
Yeah.
So I mean that if it took them 2 days to come up with that, then maybe they're not so good at improv.
Yeah, well, again, it's as I said earlier about the jigsaw puzzle. You know, some of the pieces that we have, they're difficult to pass, as it were, in and of themselves, because, you know, just as isolated things, they don't necessarily make sense. I mean, why would a person in that situation, but because you have to find a reason that he hadn't spoken directly to his wife. I mean, because, you know, that has to be justified. Any logical thinking person is going to say, if you're going to make any phone call, you're going to make it directly to the authorities who you believe can help you out, or you're going to make it directly to your loved ones and say, you know, I'm in trouble. I think I'm going to die. See you on the other side, as it were.
Right. And you have to wonder whether the reason that he didn't want to speak to the loved ones was because it wasn't him at all, but it was somebody impersonating him.
Yes. Well, you know, it's very definitely a possibility, I think, because if you look at how many of the records or the representations of the phone calls that were offered are verifiable in any way, there's really only a couple. As I said earlier, Betty Ong, because her, you know, the voice of someone purported to be Betty Ong is recorded. The voice of C.C. Lyles is recorded by her answering machine at home. And apart from those two, it seems to me, you know, all of the other ones, and the other very important one, I think, is Thomas Burnett, because his wife, Dina, is one of those people who is adamant and has been over the whole course of the investigation, as it were, that it didn't happen the way the FBI were claiming. They were trying to tell her that, well, it couldn't have been the cell phone. And she said, well, it was the cell phone, because I recognized the number on my caller ID. So these are the ones which I think, you know, if we're going to have a hierarchy of evidence, these are the ones which we should take most seriously or look at most closely. And then you can go down the line and say, well, these other ones, you know, are they as valid a piece of evidence as they are being presented to be?
Right. And when we're thinking through all this, you know, we're imagining these different possibilities, different explanations, different scenarios. In a sense, what we're doing in our minds is analogous to writing fiction. And your book, it's a novel whose title, Vigilant Guardians, refers to an exercise that may have gone live on 9/11. Sort of also implicitly refers to another way that fact and fiction get mixed up, which is when exercises, which are essentially fictional plots that are acted out almost like stage plays by the national security state, you know, military exercises, those are actually sort of works of fiction. They're imagining a certain kind of fictional scenario and acting them out. So fact and fiction is getting mixed up here in a lot of ways. And when we don't really know what happened about in a major historical event, that's also a mix up of fact and fiction. Thomas Pynchon's book, I remember the name is Bleeding Edge, actually is very much geared towards, you know, suggesting that 9/11 was the moment when we lost the ability to determine any difference between fact and fiction. I mean, he's always been playing with that idea, but I think he's in that book, he's saying that 9/11 exemplifies a kind of transition out of a fact-based world into a world where there's no more distinction between fact and fiction. And, you know, I don't know. Do you think it's gone that far?
Yeah, I kind of think that, excuse me, I'm just going to have to cough. I do believe that it has for very, very many people. And again, that was exactly why I chose that route, because it seemed to me that all of the other areas had been and have been tried successfully in one way. I mean, the work of David Ray Griffin or Stephen Jones or Tony Zambodi or David Chandler, anyone can look at these, you know, the work of these people, and they can see in that work, as I say, absolute reasons for discounting the official 9/11 narrative and trying to find, you know, a more viable alternative. That wasn't something that I could or can do. So it seemed to me that the fictionalization and the storytelling aspect was my only real alternative. And because, as you say, there are so, if you look at historically what had been happening before 9/11, if you look at Clancy's novel, for example, executive orders in which, you know, surprise, surprise, a 747 crashes into the Capitol building. You know, that's what we would have to call foreshadowing to some degree. There's a movie starring Kirk Douglas called Executive. Now, that's Executive Decision is the movie. Exactly the same scenario. It was put out in 1996, I think, where a terrorist played by Ben Kingsley takes over a 747 and is intending to crash that into buildings in Washington. And then you have, you know, the famous Lone Gunman episode of the TV show in which, again, the exact same 9/11 scenario is foreshadowed.
Yeah, the Lone Gunman.
Yeah. So all of these things are being used by, you know, if you wish to call them the other side. But all of these tropes have been and had been presented prior to 9/11 in a way, as I say, it's kind of foreshadowing the event and getting people to see and accept it as a possibility, but through the use of fictional devices. And they do tend to blur and mesh in people's minds. And so, yeah, I think it's categorically a process that, you know, certain people, certain organizations know works and has utilized for quite a very long time now, since, you know, the beginning of the age of television, really, if you want to get right down to it. I think that's where it all changed. The great God television coming into our world. And that's the thing about 9/11. It was the spectacular television event of all time. But my contention, personally, is that it was going to be a lot more spectacular, because it seems to me that the collapse of the Twin Towers were dramatic enough, but they would have been capped off by the final event, which logically would have been Flight 93 coming in over southern Manhattan to collide with World Trade Center 7, whilst literally every camera in New York and every television watching person on the planet was there to see it. And then at 9:30, which is, you know, about 5 minutes after that, it seems to me would have occurred if the plan had gone correctly, President Bush would have been holding his scheduled press conference from Florida to explain to the world that suddenly, you know, everything was different. And the thing is, we forget or we don't think about Flight 77. And, you know, that was probably, to my mind, supposed to occur at exactly the time that the entire world was watching George Bush on television make his statement. And that's what I mean when I talk about why I believe the plan as it stood did not actually occur in a fundamental sense in the way that it was supposed to on the day. And that was because Flight 93 was 40 minutes delayed.
Mm-hmm. And it's interesting how that could actually be the glitch that unravels the whole thing by putting Building 7 out there as the ultimate smoking gun of 9/11 that, you know, anybody can see as an obvious controlled demolition and pre-announced by the BBC or, you know, and the BBC, of course, spent a few weeks denying that they had any 9/11 footage. They said they'd lost all their 9/11 footage, so we don't know if this purported Jane Stanley reporting Building 7 coming down 20 minutes early is authentic or not. So they kept that pretense up for a few weeks. And then finally they said, well, we actually found our 9/11 footage. Somehow we had misplaced it. But now we found it. And yes, we've confirmed that this is authentic footage of Jane Stanley reporting Building 7 down 20 minutes before it came down. But we admit it was a mistake, and we're very sorry for the mistake. End of story.
End of story.
Can't make this stuff up.
We're not going to go any further into that, even though it is, as you say, of all of the smoking guns, and there are many, you know, that's pretty high up on the list. But, yeah, at the end of the novel, Vigilant Guardians, basically there's a character who reiterates that basic position. Building 7, if it comes to pass that any kind of fundamental change of heart or any renewed investigation, which I personally don't hold out any hope for. There hasn't been a new Warren Commission in 50 years. I don't think there's going to be a new 9/11 Commission in 50 years. But if the world in greater portion comes to see that the official narrative cannot be true, and I personally hope, like you do, I'm sure, to contribute to that process in whatever small way that I can, it will be predicated on 9/11. Rather, Building 7. And it's inescapable fact, which is you've got a building that just falls down for no reason and it collapses in part at free fall speed, which can only be explained by the removal of its structural material instantaneously, which is a process that can only in this world that we're aware of be obtained by the use of explosives of some stripe. It's really as simple as that to my mind. But as I say, on the other hand, I don't think there would be a truth movement at all had the plan gone according to what I think was its intention, and had that final plane struck that building live on television, and that building, you know, collapsed within a few minutes, just as the Twin Towers had done previously. You know, I don't think the truth movement as we know it would exist, because people would just laugh at you, you know, in the way that some will do just with regards to the Twin Towers. We saw the planes hit the building. We saw the building fall down, you know, QED. That's the cause. That's what happened.
Well, you know, I think one of the ways that this confusion of fact and fiction has been used by the perpetrators to cover their tracks is that, you know, I agree with you that, you know, as Neil Postman has written in Amusing Ourselves to Death, television turned everything into amusement and into fiction. And that's just how we now experience the world in the post-television age. And 9/11 was the apotheosis of television in this respect. But I think there was a psychological dimension as well, in which when people, you know, were told to turn on their TVs, you've got to see this. Everybody turns on their TVs and it's a, you know, War of the Worlds style sort of, we interrupt this broadcast, you know, here's New York, a plane has crashed into a building, this sort of thing. And people's first reaction is going to be, wow, this looks like a movie. And then, of course, when the towers blow up and giant people eating pyroclastic clouds are chasing people down the streets of New York, everybody says, wow, this looks just like a disaster movie. So many people have reported that was their first thought. And I think that this confusion between the Hollywood movie that it looked like you were seeing and then this insistence that it was reality by we interrupt this broadcast, most historic, important event, blah, 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 that confusion actually psychologically paralyzed people in part, because when we watch a disaster movie, we enjoy watching things getting blown up. Now, Tom Robbins, the novelist, has said that Americans just love to watch stuff being blown up because we have way too much stuff. We all just wish we could blow it all up, and so we get off on watching things being blown up. And so,
Mythbusters is a case in point.
So people are watching this. And half of them is like, really, you know, wow, this is a disaster movie. You dig it. Wow, what an amazing, cool image. The other half is being told it's real and there are thousands of people being murdered in front of your eyes. And the conflict between these things forces people to basically repress their Hollywood view of the event deep into their unconscious and to insist fanatically on the real, it really happened view. And their guilt, which has now been, you know, brought down into their unconscious, just paralyzes them. They're no longer able to think rationally about it.
Yeah, no, I think that pretty much sums all of it up. It becomes a totally unrational scenario. It's predicated in the end only on an emotional response, and that is, you know, dramatically more powerful for most people most of the time. The emotions associated with the experience and those which will always really, well, not always, but frequently hold sway in the end. And that was why it worked, because, you know, on the one hand, if the narrative were genuinely true, you'd have to call it the most unsuccessful terrorist event of all times in terms of achieving anything for the putative terrorists.
Indeed.
But at the other hand, if you're calling it a false flag event, then, you know, there has been nothing as successful in the world today. And all of these, you know, subsequent minor, or more minor events, rather, that you want to look at, they're really still just a shadow of, you know, Big Daddy, as it were. Your opinions on the Boston Marathon bombing, for example, or the Charlie Hebdo event, even if you want to consider them to be of a similar ilk, they really are not a patch on the big one.
And I think that people, well, there have been waves of skepticism sweeping across the internet after these events. And with Charlie Hebdo, the president of France came out and said that we need to think about banning conspiracy theories at the French, European, and international levels. And then his pet think tank singled me out as one of the world's five leading intellectuels conspirationistes. presumably, I'm going to be persona non grata if I go to France to talk about this book, We Are Not Charlie Hebdo.
Yeah.
So it seems like they might be running a little bit scared because the internet is so just boiling over with skepticism whenever this kind of thing happens.
Mm.
I hope so.
Yeah, no, well, that's what I, you know, in terms of my efforts, I think the best that I could do or contribute to is awakening some kind of skepticism in any individual. I think that's the best that we can hope for in this world is to...
Well, if you want to help awaken or at least awaken some skepticism in your friends, give them Vigilant Guardians, the novel by David Allen Glynn. It's the best 9/11 truth thriller yet. Congratulations, David. Keep up the good work.
Well, thank you very much, Kevin. Much appreciated. Nice talking to you.
Okay, thank you. This is Truth Jihad Radio, back next week. See you then.
Enter into a world unseen on Raven Star's Witching Hour. You will encounter eclectic topics from the realm of spirit brought into our matrix of truth. With your host, the Solaris Blue Raven. Solaris will bring you an array of unique guests covering topics from ghostly spirits to amazing anomalies, covert technology, UFOs, and shadowy global events.
And that's right here at Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com, Saturdays, midnight till 2 a.m. Eastern Time. Revolution Radio, where information never sleeps.
Let the magic rise.